Martin put his spoon down.
"Are you trying to kill me?"
he asked as politely as he could.
"If I were trying to kill you, you'd know it, because you'd be dead. Don't be such a baby. It's perfectly safe. It's been boiling non-stop for weeks. It's a whole lot cleaner than the bowl I put it in, that's for sure."
"That doesn't help."
"Look, I've added water occasionally and thrown in more vegetables when I get them. This is how they do things here. Didn't you ever wonder how people survived without refrigerators? It was tricks like this. Also, letting the stew cook down over the course of days intensifies the flavors."
"Maybe so, but not all flavors are good," Martin said, eyeing the stew as if it might attack him.
"Look," Philip said, "I told you not to go after Gwen, and after much deliberation you decided to do as I say. I'm telling you to eat your stew. Sadly, we don't have time for you to decide that I'm right. We have to go and not hit on my friend Gwen."
Once Martin had half-heartedly choked down some stew, he and Philip teleported to the street outside Gwen's shop. It wouldn't have been a long walk, but Philip didn't have any customers lined up, and he didn't like to let a day go by without some public demonstration of his power. Inside the shop, they found Gwen talking to a peasant woman wearing what appeared to be a burlap coat. The woman was holding one arm straight out at shoulder level and was pointing at it with the other hand. At first, Martin thought she was doing some kind of Tai Chi move, but then he realized she was just complaining.
"The sleeves are too long. You don't have to be a bloody tailor to see that."
She had a point. Her fingers were barely showing beyond the line of the cuff. Gwen looked perplexed.
"Are you hunching your shoulders?"
"Are you calling me a liar?"
Gwen held up her hands.
"No, not at all. I'm sorry, I'm just mystified. Cloth shrinks. It doesn't grow. And even if it did, it wouldn't grow faster in one direction than in the other."
"Well, it is. I just bought this coat 3 months ago, and now it doesn't fit."
"We both agreed it fit fine when you bought it."
"Well, now it don't."
Gwen thought a moment.
"You live near to Sam, don't you?"
"We both live in Rickard's Bend. What's that got to do with anything?"
"Nothing, I'm sure. Look, I'm sorry for the trouble. Leave the coat with me. I'll hem the sleeves for free. Please come back in a week. It'll be done."
The woman handed Gwen the coat and left. As she passed Martin, he heard her mutter,
"Now to go settle up with that bloody cobbler."
"Tough morning, Gwen?"
Philip asked.
"Nothing I can't handle so far."
Gwen looked pointedly at Martin. Martin smiled.
"Good morning, Gwen. It's good to see you."
Good morning, Martin. So, gentlemen, ready for the rough fitting?"
Gwen asked Martin to remove the blood-red loner robe and hat. She unfolded a robe made of thin, off-white cloth, which he held up like a man helping his wife put her coat on. As Martin slid his arms into the robe, Gwen explained.
"This is just a rough template I made to your measurements. Once this fits properly, I'll make the real thing out of more expensive fabric."
Martin swung his arms around.
"How's it feel?"
Gwen asked.
"A little tight through the chest, but other than that, it feels good."
Gwen made a note. She pulled at the seams where the shoulders met the sleeves, held her measuring stick along the side of the sleeve, and took another measurement.
The shoulders aren't sitting quite right either."
Martin said,
"It'll be fine. You know what you're doing. What fabric have you chosen?"
"I have a couple of ideas. I didn't want to settle on anything until I saw your staff. Or are you the wan type?"
With great effort, Martin let this pass without comment, simply turning to Philip and asking,
"Could you please hand me my staff?"
Philip took the staff Martin had left leaning against the wall and handed it directly to Gwen. She looked at the small bust of Santo in his shiny silver mask.
"Fearsome,"
she said.
"What is it?"
Martin puffed up a bit and explained.
"That is the grim visage of the saint of the southern country, destroyer of monsters and leader of men. He vanquished and later befriended the blue demon."
It was the first time Martin had gotten to use the description he'd prepared, and he was pretty happy with it. Gwen seemed impressed. Gwen put a conical hat made of the same flimsy fabric on Martin's head. They discussed how it fit. Gwen took a few more measurements and told Philip and Martin to come back in a week for the final fitting, and if no further revisions were needed, they could take the robe home then. As they left, the angry woman with the oversized coat came back in, now barefoot. Her leggings were stretched down past her heel onto her foot. She said,
"You got me so angry talking about the coat, I plumb forgot to mention that my leggings are too long as well."
Martin and Philip returned to the hut and worked until that time of the day when it was almost not the day anymore, but it wasn't quite night yet. The sun was still in the sky. It was low in the sky, but it was there. When it finally went down, the world would have a brand new night, with all the promise and opportunity that a night offers. But the world wasn't there yet. Before the new night could begin, the old day had to end. And it was grinding slowly to a halt. Birds were singing, quietly. Rabbits were mating, tiredly. People were doing their work, half-heartedly. In Philip's hut, he and Martin were just finishing up a discussion about transporting complex objects, a complex problem, which Philip could tell was completely failing to hold Martin's interest. Philip was annoyed by this until he realized that he couldn't remember what the last sentence he'd said was, because he'd been more interested in obsessing about Martin's lack of interest.
"Let's break for the day and have dinner," Philip said.
"Great idea," Martin replied.
Philip stood up, walked over to the stew pot, turned and saw that Martin had walked the opposite direction and was standing next to the door with his staff in hand.
"Where are you going?"
Philip asked.
"To get dinner," Martin answered.
"But we have stew here," Philip said.
"That's why I'm eating somewhere else," Philip said.
"What do you think you're going to eat?"
"Anything but stew?"
Martin left before Philip could protest any further. Martin didn't wish to eat any more stew, but he also wanted to stretch his legs and see more of the town. If he just said so, he was sure Philip would have gone out for a walk with him, which would have been nice, but not as nice as going alone, because part of his view of the town would have been blocked by Philip, and he had seen Philip enough. Philip's hut stood near the edge of town, so of the four directions Martin could walk, one led out into the woods, two led along the outskirts of civilization, and the last would take him into the heart of Ledchurch. Martin set a course for the center of town and started walking. Martin knew that he cut an imposing figure in his borrowed blood-red robe and hat, carrying his staff with the fearsome visage of Santo staring out at the world. Martin tried to balance this by smiling and appearing friendly, but as he walked down the street, he found that the people who were still out milling around gave him a lot of room. They didn't seem unhappy to see him, just happier to see him from a distance. Martin thought about his dinner options. He could go to the rotted stump and buy some food, but given the first impression he had made on the owner, he didn't like his chances of getting clean, unadulterated food out of that place. Frankly, he didn't like anybody's chances of getting unadulterated food from Pete, but he figured any food that Pete knew was going to Martin would probably be pretty adult by the time he got it. Martin decided to turn right at the next intersection, then left at the one after that. Instead of walking directly to the center of town, the same way he and Philip had before, he would go via a slightly different route. Ledchurch was small, but there were still parts of it he hadn't seen. Martin wanted to fix that. Martin thought, there must be somewhere to buy some food in this place other than just the rotted stump. He was sure he'd seen a guy selling fruit and vegetables out of a cart the other day. Of course, he probably irrigated it with filthy water, but I can always wash whatever I buy with the local water, which is also filthy. Martin realized that he hadn't thought this little expedition through very well. He considered going back to his own time to get some real food. The problem there was that he didn't have full shell access, so he couldn't use whatever simplified tools the local wizards had developed for time travel. He could edit the raw file directly, which was possible, but difficult using his phone's tiny screen and twitchy on-screen keyboard. And time travel and teleportation were not activities in which one wanted to risk a mistake. His safest option was to use his app, which would always take him back to the exact time and place from which he last left, so that would mean raiding his parents' fridge, which would be awkward given the fact that federal agents were laying siege to their house.
"I could have something delivered, a pizza or Chinese or something," he thought. "I wonder if the delivery guy would fight his way past the treasury agents if I promised to tip him an extra 20.
Martin was so delighted at the image of a minimum wage pizza deliverer elbowing his way past armed law enforcement officers that he forgot to pay attention to where he was going. He didn't collide with another person, or walk into a stationary object, but he suddenly looked around and realized that his surroundings had changed. The light seemed dimmer. The huts that lined the road were less well cared for, and many didn't seem to be structurally sound. The animals looked malnourished, and what carts he did see were not in good repair. His fellow pedestrians were the most unsettling part. They weren't doing anything overtly threatening, but they were all watching Martin like a hawk.
"Stay cool," Martin told himself. "There's nothing to worry about. I'm a wizard, after all. Just keep walking. Act like you belong here, and you'll be fine. Of course, I don't have all of my wizard powers yet, but none of these people know that. Someone would have to be pretty stupid to pick a fight with me. Or a really, really good fighter. Or possibly both."
A voice from across the street called out,
"Hey! Hey, you!"
Martin had never in his life had a sentence that started with, "Hey, you," end in a way that made him happy. Despite this, he reflexively turned toward the voice, regretting it immediately. Across the street, he saw a huge man, both tall and broad, built out of solid muscle in exactly the way that makes a man look terrible with his shirt off. Fortunately, he was wearing a chainmail vest. Unfortunately, his prodigious chest hairs were poking out through the mail, giving the viewer the impression that the chainmail was blurry. Several other young men who were smaller than the big guy, but still larger than Martin, were hanging around. Martin had seen their type before. Really, anybody who attended public high school had. They were tough young thugs, looking for a good time, and the easiest way to find a good time for them was to make sure someone else was having a bad time. Martin and the big man locked eyes. He gave Martin a look that said both, "How dare you look at me," and, "Yeah, you better look at me when I'm talking to you." He started crossing the street, walking directly toward Martin. Big patches of the man's hair were missing. Martin wasn't sure if they'd been pulled out in a fight or fallen out due to some awful illness. The big man smiled. Several teeth were missing, and Martin still wasn't sure whether to blame violence or disease. The man's nose looked like it spent more time broken than not. The big man walked up to Martin, standing close enough that he couldn't be accused of touching him, but couldn't be prevented from it if he chose to. He kept his eyes locked on Martin, but turned his head slightly, as if talking over his shoulder to someone behind him.
"Hey, boys, look who's here. This must be that new wizard we heard about."
The other punks filled in all around, surrounding Martin on both sides. They were all smiling. None of them looked friendly. One felt the fabric of Martin's robe. Another repeatedly flicked the point of Martin's hat. A third looked at the bust of Santo at the head of Martin's staff and made a face, growling at the masked luchadore. The big one said,
"I hear the town wizard is teaching you. Is that right? Maybe you'd like to practice on us, huh? Show us what you've learned. Does that sound like fun? I think it does."
Martin mentally ran through his options. His brain was in high gear, burning through ideas so quickly that it didn't even form words, just a stream of concepts. He could try talking to them, but that's exactly what thugs like this wanted, to prolong things and make you squirm. He had his phone, he could use it to hover or teleport, but hovering was useless, and anyway, to teleport he'd have to pull the phone out and turn it on, which would just give them the opportunity to try to take it from him. He'd have to use the powers he'd already been taught by Philip. He was invulnerable. He could just let them pound on him until they got tired, but that didn't sound like fun. He could copy things. Of course, copying the thugs would be counterproductive, but he could copy a bunch of gold pieces and buy them off. He dismissed the idea immediately. It was cowardly and would have just given them incentive to attack him again. He could levitate objects. He remembered Philip tormenting him with the flying goat. Martin held his staff in front of himself, said, "Levi objecto," then shoved his staff forward with both hands. The big guy flew backwards and rolled to a stop in an undignified heap. Unfortunately, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And while there were ways to counteract this, Philip had not yet seen the need to teach them to Martin, since he had only levitated very small objects. The act of shoving the brute had also shoved Martin backwards even farther. He instantly realized what had happened, but was helpless to stop it. He slid to a stop on his backside. Looking up, he saw the smaller thugs still standing right where they had been, but with a gap in the middle where Martin and their leader had flown away. Beyond the gang standing there with their mouths hanging open, Martin saw their leader, slowly lifting himself out of the dirt with murder in his eyes. One of the smaller gang members said,
"He knocked down Kluge!"
in an awed voice. Martin had to think fast. He had one power he could use as a weapon, and it seemed to have a fatal flaw, but perhaps he could turn it to his advantage. At the end of the street, directly behind the one they called Kluge, who was now on his feet and walking toward Martin with terrible purpose, Martin saw a tall, sturdy-looking tree. Martin leapt to his feet, pointed his staff at the upper branches of the tree, and cried, "Levi Obiecto!" The tree did not move. The thug sneered and laughed. Good, Martin thought. He hauled back on his staff as if it were a fishing pole and he was trying to land a marlin. If the tree had been floating in the air, this would have pulled it toward Martin with great force, but it was not. The tree was rooted to the ground. So instead of the tree being pulled toward Martin, Martin was pulled toward the tree. Martin streaked through the gaggle of punks, who flew in every direction. He hit Kluge directly in the chest with both feet, knocking him back down into the dirt. Martin's trajectory flattened, and he slid to a stop on the dirt road, barely managing to stay on his feet. He released the levitation spell and looked behind him. The thugs were struggling to their feet. Kluge rolled over onto his stomach and looked up, locking eyes on Martin, who sprinted back to the main drag and nominally familiar territory. He turned right at the next intersection and was back on the same street he and Philip had used to walk into the center of town. From here, he'd be able to find his way back to Philip's shop, Gwen's shop, or the lead church. But before any of those things, he knew he'd find the ramshackle fruit stand he'd been seeking for very different reasons just a few moments ago. Martin was aware of several very heavy-sounding sets of feet running behind him. He knew the gang was chasing him, and he suspected they were gaining ground. As he got closer to the fruit stand, he saw the very thing he'd been hoping for. Pumpkins! Martin slid to a stop, a calculated risk, but one he had to take. He aimed his staff at a large pumpkin, said, "Levi Obiecto!" and raised the staff over his head like an axe. He saw that the pumpkin was obeying his command. He pivoted, observing that the gang was still about 50 feet behind him. They had been gaining, but now, seeing him standing his ground with a blunt object in his hand and a heavy-looking gourd hovering above him, they screeched to a halt. Martin leveled his staff directly at the leader, Kluge, and the pumpkin streaked straight at him. Martin aimed for his chest, specifically for the two muddy footprints that marked where Martin had bounced off of him before, but Kluge turned and blocked it with his arm, the projectiles exploding in a cloud of pumpkin rind and guts. The rest of the gang shielded their faces from the residual flying seeds and goo. Martin turned, levitating a second pumpkin, which he spun in an orbit around himself, swinging his staff like a samurai sword. He picked out the second largest thug, then pointed his staff at him. The thug knew what was coming and dodged, but the pumpkin still struck the smaller man behind him, knocking him off of his feet with an undignified yelp. After that, everyone scattered. Even the man who'd just been struck crawled quickly, then shambled to his feet before limping away as fast as he could. The only one left was Kluge, rolling on the ground, moaning. Martin turned his back and walked casually to the fruit stand. He asked what he owed for the two pumpkins, paying the total from his coin purse. As he handed the gold to the fruit seller, he saw fear in the man's eyes. Martin turned to see Kluge, who was nearly on top of him, holding a large rock over his head. Martin stretched out his hand and again said, "Levi Obiecto!" He lifted Kluge into the air, spinning and cursing. Martin braced himself against the pushback and gently sent Kluge drifting away down the street and high into the air, as if he were a helium balloon, and Martin had simply let go of the string. Martin said, "Drop the rock!" Kluge shouted and cursed and threatened to do a lot more than that if Martin didn't put him down. "Drop the rock!" Martin repeated before adding, "Or I'll drop you!" Kluge dropped the rock. Martin looked at him, floating in space, shouting obscenities. He drew Kluge in closer so they could talk.
"Really, he's a lot like the goat that Philip levitated," Martin thought. "He chased me around. He's unpleasant and nasty, but in the end, he's really no threat to me at all.
He brought Kluge in close enough that he could almost reach out and grab him. Almost, but not quite. After trying several times, Kluge gave up and simply hung there, giving Martin the eye.
"This ain't over, wizard," he said. "Me and me boys will be watching you. Count on it."
Martin smiled.
"I hope you do watch, and I hope you pay close attention to what you see, because as long as you see me with this staff here in my hand, there's nothing you can do to hurt me."
Martin lifted Kluge high into the air, then sent him far into the distance toward the tallest building in town, the lead church. Kluge grasped the steeple with both arms, and Martin released him. Martin saw him slide down the steeple, heard faint, distant yelling. He looked around and for the first time saw that the street was lined with people who had seen the entire exchange. Martin thrust his hand into his robe pocket and grasped his phone. He craned his head and peeked at the screen through the voluminous pocket's opening. While his app booted up, he looked up and smiled at the villagers, who were still watching him silently, out of fear and shock. Martin glanced back down at the phone, chose the teleportation function, and estimated the location of Philip's hut. Martin looked up, smiled brightly, tapped the brim of his wizard hat with the head of his staff, and disappeared. Martin reappeared at the far end of the road, about 30 feet beyond Philip's hut. He quickly scampered to the door and ducked inside. Philip was still sitting at the table, reading an old issue of Omni magazine. He looked up and said,
"Back so soon?"
Martin said,
"Yeah, I decided Stew sounded pretty good."
The next afternoon found Philip and Martin in an empty field miles from town. The field was bordered on one side by forest and on the other side by the sea. Philip was carrying what looked like an artist's easel and a large dartboard.
"Today we're going to talk about mystical rays and beams," he said as he set up the target with its back to the sea.
"How long did it take you to get used to saying things like that without feeling silly?" Martin asked.
"I'm still working on it. Anyway, you already know how to levitate small objects and move them through the air. That alone is one of your most powerful defensive weapons. But in an actual fight, simply hurling heavy objects at people leaves something to be desired."
"It's not that impressive," Martin agreed. "I mean, making things float is cool, but everybody knows we can do that already. And at the end of the day, there's not a lot of difference between throwing a rock at someone and magically throwing a rock at someone."
Philip nodded.
"That is one issue, but the more immediate problem is that it could kill them. If it's in self-defense, that's one thing, but our goal is to prove that we have powers, not to prove that we are murderers. The beauty of mystical beams and rays is that you can make them look horrifically violent while being deliberately non-lethal."
Philip and Martin stood about 100 feet from the target.
"Okay, Martin, you're wearing a robe and hat. You've got your staff. What's the first rule of using your staff?"
"Don't make the obvious joke."
"Top man! Now, I want you to stare at the target. Concentrate hard on it. I want you to say, 'Radion de Ruja Lumo,' when you think you're ready."
Martin stared at the target. It seemed to loom impossibly large in his perception. He imagined it being obliterated by his will. He exhaled slowly, and when his lungs were almost depleted, he said,
"Radion de Ruja Lumo."
An awe-inspiring amount of nothing happened. Martin turned to Philip and pointed at the target.
"It's still there. What'd I do wrong?"
Philip said,
"Say it again."
Martin furrowed his brow.
"Say what again?
Radion de Ruja Lumo?" A bright beam of light, the width of Martin's arm, shot from Martin's pointing hand directly into the target. Martin gaped at it for a moment, then let out a whoop. He raised his hand to look at it, and the ray angled into the sky. He aimed it back at the target, then at the ocean, then at a tree, then at a rock. The whole time he was giggling like a maniac.
"As I said," Philip said, "the shell is always monitoring us. It's not just waiting for commands, it's also looking for signals. Of course, it won't let you do anything without a staff, a wand, a robe, and a hat. But there are subtle clues as to your intent built into those items.
The robe has 2-foot cuffs, because that's how the shell knows where your hands are. It watches for you to make a pointing gesture, and that's how it knows where to target things. It took us a few years to get the programming right. For a long time, we could only shoot beams from our staffs and wands. You can still use your staff to shoot rays if you like. It can look very impressive, and can help with long-range accuracy if you hold it like a rifle. Also, if you think you're ready, you're welcome to stop shooting me with your beam.
Martin laughed and changed his aim so that the ray was no longer hitting Philip in the chest. He aimed at the grass between them. The ray brilliantly illuminated a 4-inch circle of grass, but was clearly doing no damage.
I assume this is some kind of harmless learner's energy beam?
Of course. Your hand is a glorified flashlight.
Still, it's awfully cool. Thanks for showing me how to do this.
You're welcome, Martin.
They stared at the spot of grass illuminated by the beam.
Bill, would you show me how to stop it?
Sure, you know how already. What's Esperanto for stop?
Martin laughed at himself and said,
Halti!
The beam disappeared.
Okay, now we're going to move on to something genuinely dangerous, so no kidding around.
Gotcha.
Good. I want you to carefully point at the target and say, Radion Devarmo, when you're ready.
Martin did as Philip told him, and the target burst into flames.
I can't see the beam, he said.
That's right. Simple beams like the ones we've been playing with usually either look cool or do something useful, but not both. If you want to accomplish something and look good doing it, you have to shoot more than one beam at once. You could tell the shell, beam of heat and light, and make a loud noise, and surround me with sparkly stuff. But that's a lot to translate into Esperanto on the fly. That's why the next thing we study will be making macros.
Cool, Martin said. Why isn't my hand burning?
We built a safety feature into the shell. The ray, all rays actually, start 3 inches beyond your hand.
Philip pulled a long blade of grass out of the ground and touched it to Martin's pointing finger. It was unharmed. Slowly he moved the blade away from Martin's finger toward the target, and at the 3-inch point it burst into flames.
Mind if I stop?
Martin asked.
Feel free,
Martin said.
Halti!
There was no visible difference, but he pointed at the ground and the grass was unharmed, so clearly the beam had stopped. He looked at the smoldering ashes of the target.
Sorry I destroyed your target, he said.
Philip patted him on the back.
Don't be. I borrowed it from Gary.
Later that afternoon, Philip and Martin sat at the keyboard of the Commodore 64. Philip removed the crystal ball and put the monitor, an old 11-inch color TV with a faux wood grain exterior, up on the table so they could both see it. Philip said,
You remember the night we met? That display I put on before I sent you flying into the trees?
Yes, I remember that.
Well, that was what we call a macro. I'm sure you're aware of the idea of a macro.
Yeah, Martin said. It's a simple program that allows you to execute several actions with one command.
Exactly. That's all that was. I sat down in advance and thought up an entertaining series of commands and programmed the shell to execute them for me if I do certain things. In that case, I twirl my staff and quietly hum a few notes of Ride of the Valkyries. We all program our own macros. Some are useful. Some are for show. When we get together, sometimes we have a duel to see whose macro is the most impressive. You could say it's like breakdancing for wizards.
I could, but I like you, so I won't. What was that you hit me with, by the way?
Philip shrugged.
I can't tell you all of my secrets. But since you've experienced that particular beam firsthand, I suppose there's no harm in telling you that the active ingredient was a 1-foot-wide column of wind.
Wind? I was blasted into the forest by wind?
200-mile-an-hour wind?
Yeah, I guess that'd do it. So, how do I make a macro?
It's just a matter of basic computer scripting. I'm sure it's nothing you can't handle on that, pocket computer of yours.
Martin pulled out his smartphone, looked at it, and bit his lip.
Bill, I've done some programming, and the thing is, I could probably write the macros on this, but it wouldn't be a lot of fun. This isn't really a computer.
I mean, it is really a computer, but in my time, we really don't use these as computers. Philip looked confused.
What do you use them for, then?
They really haven't told you anything about the future, have they? This is my phone.
A phone? You use it as a phone? You carry around a device that's the size of a deck of cards and is more powerful than a Cray supercomputer, and you use it as a phone.
I also play games on it and watch a movie occasionally.
You can watch movies on that?
Not many. I mean, I only have a 16-gig memory card in it. Philip muttered almost to himself.
My Commodore has 64 kilobytes of memory and a floppy drive that stores 170K. You can double that, but you have to cut a notch in the disk.
Then, loud and clear, Philip said,
I kind of hate you right now.
I guess that's why nobody tells you about the future.
I guess. Anyway, that'll have to wait. We have some work to do this afternoon.
What kind of work?
Nothing too taxing. Just a quick exorcism.
17. Martin and Philip teleported back to the shop so Philip could grab a few things. He lurched around the room, picking up a couple of bottles, a small human figure made of twigs, and a dried, dead frog, which he handed to Martin.
Here, take this.
Martin held the dead frog gingerly, dangling it by two fingers.
Why do I have to hold the frog corpse?
I wanted to see if you would,
Philip answered, looking at the frog and shuddering.
Ugh, disgusting.
Philip walked into the crystal ballroom. Martin followed. Philip consulted a scrap of paper and punched some commands into the Commodore 64.
I agreed to this exorcism a couple of weeks ago. That was before you showed up, of course.
When you say exorcism, what do you mean? Philip smiled, but didn't look up from his work as he talked.
I mean that some local thinks his son is possessed by a demon, and we've been asked to remove it.
But there is no demon. Right?
That depends on how you look at it. If you consider rebelliousness, sullenness, and liking things that their parents hate to be demonic, then yes, we live surrounded by demons.
I didn't know wizards handled this sort of thing. I thought it was the church's department.
It is,
Philip said.
And that's why we'll be working with my friend, His Excellency Father Galbreath, the Bishop of Ledchurch.
Martin was confused again. I figured the church would be against the use of magic.
It was, before we came along. Back when wizards were just crazy men with no powers and a mystical belief system that they couldn't really prove, the clergy was their sworn enemy. Kind of like two used car dealerships set up on the same street. Hmm? Both sides claimed to have all the answers, but couldn't demonstrate that they were right without resorting to a lot of arm-waving and suggesting that people look around them and think about it. They couldn't prove themselves right. So they channeled their energies into proving the other side wrong. Then we came along with our irritating ability to prove that we had powers. We put the fake wizards right out of business, and the more practical-minded members of the church, Bishop Galbreath among them, decided that they had to find a way to explain our existence that was consistent with their belief system.
How do they explain us?
They just say we were created by God.
Fair enough. Why do they say God created wizards?
For a reason.
Okay, I'm still with you. What is that reason?
The reason is beyond man's understanding.
Martin thought about this.
That's not much of an explanation.
No, but it is consistent with their beliefs. The advantage that religion has over magic or science is that man's inability to understand is built into the system. So if an explanation is confusing or unsatisfying, it strengthens the point.
Martin was clearly having difficulty with this conversation, and Philip knew that they should not proceed until whatever was bothering Martin was settled.
So if the church is a sham, why are you working with one of the perpetrators?
Martin asked. Philip said,
I didn't say the church is a sham.
He put his bottles and dead frog down, then leaned against the counter, settling in for some good, solid explaining.
I said that they can't prove their belief system, and that the lack of proof is part of that system. It's all belief and no proof. You and I, we're both science guys. In science, you question everything and prove ideas through experimentation. It's all proof and no belief. It's easy for us to sneer at the church for claiming the earth was created in 6 days, 5,000 years ago, when there's clear evidence that it's much older. But you and I can prove that the earth is part of a computer program. And how long did it take to write that program? 5 days, perhaps? How long has the program been running? 5,000 cycles, perhaps? Who programmed it? Maybe their initials are G-O-D, and they have a sense of humor. Even if none of those answers line up with the church's doctrine, what is our Creator's reality based on? Is he in a computer program? Nobody has all the answers, because all the best answers generate more questions. The way I see it, religion is no more inherently evil than science is. It's just a matter of who's using it and how. And Bishop Galbraith is a good man. He's a gruff, cantankerous old fart, but a good man. And when our goals align, I'm happy to work with him. So, Martin, if you're ready, let's go forth as men of science and help a medieval bishop exorcise a demon.
In front of a small farmhouse on the outskirts of town, an old man in black sat on a white horse and waited. His robes, leggings, shirt, and hat were all slightly different shades of black. Around his neck there was a rough leather thong holding a cross that appeared to be hammered by hand from a chunk of raw iron. The fact that wristwatches weren't invented yet made it difficult to look impatient, but he managed. He squinted at the sun, which was high in the sky and partially obscured by puffy clouds. He looked at the shadows on the ground, which were stubby dark silhouettes of the trees, fence posts, and sheep. He peered down the road, seeing nothing but heat waves and dust. He scanned the horizon, finding rolling hills and occasional stone and thatch farmhouses like the one he was sitting in front of. He knew he wouldn't see what he was waiting for, but that didn't stop him from looking, or from being irritated by not finding it. Simple teleportation isn't much to look at. One moment the wizard isn't there, the next moment he is. Now that doing so wouldn't cause Martin to ask questions and jump ahead in the lesson plan, Philip used a macro to add some razzle-dazzle to the process. 2 indistinct hazes, about 3 feet off of the ground and roughly 2 feet apart, formed before the old man's eyes. A high-pitched, vaguely gurgly noise filled the air. The horse bucked a bit, because that's what one does in these situations. The sound grew louder. The 2 points of haze expanded into blotches of color and motion that took on the shapes of 2 men in robes and pointy hats. They remained unnaturally still as the sound and haze faded away, leaving them standing, holding their staffs at their sides, the older man's hand on the younger man's shoulder. When the haze had dissipated and the sound faded away, the 2 men suddenly began moving, as smoothly as if they had never stopped.
"Star Trek, nice!" Martin said. "I thought you'd like that," Philip replied. "You're late, wizard!"
the old man yelled, climbing down from his horse. Philip looked at the sky, then spread his hands in a questioning gesture.
"I said we'd meet when the sun was at its highest point!"
The old man walked slowly toward them. He could clearly still get around, but it just as clearly took more effort than it used to.
"Aye, and that time's past. I'm a busy man, you know. I can't flit about in the wink of an eye like you lot. It'll take me half the day to get back to my responsibilities in Ledchurch, and I don't have a young apprentice to help me."
"You have younger priests and several nuns?"
Philip said, walking up to meet the old man halfway.
"True, but none of them are any help."
The old man and Philip shared a laugh and a hug. Philip gestured toward Martin.
"Your Excellency, this is my apprentice, Martin."
Bishop Galbraith looked Martin over from head to toe.
"I, Martin the Magnificent, I hear. Should I call you Martin or your Magnificence?"
Martin winced and bowed slightly.
"You can call me whatever you like, sir."
"I will. You know, someone brought me in a piece of your transparent fabric.
said that any clothing made of the stuff would be indecent, wanted to know why God would allow such a thing to exist.
I'm sorry if I caused you any trouble, Martin said. He wasn't a religious man, but Philip seemed to hold the priest in high regard, so Martin was inclined to be conciliatory.
No, son. Luckily, the stuff tore easily. I told him it was the work of the devil, and, like all of Satan's creations, was flimsy and useless.
Well played, Philip said.
Thank you. Of course, now there's a peasant wandering the streets, convinced that your apprentice is the devil's loom. Well, that's not my problem.
Or mine, said Philip. So, Bishop, what are we walking into here?
Parishioners of mine, the Mellick family. The father is Donald, a good man, but stubborn, old-fashioned, ignorant, domineering, and judgmental.
Martin made a note of the bishop's definition of a good man.
His wife,
Bishop Galbraith continued,
is named Jan. A good woman, smarter than she's given credit for, excellent cook, usually lets Donald have his way because it's easier that way. They have three daughters and a son, their youngest, Donald, the younger. He's a good boy, 15 years old. Of late, he started acting differently. He's withdrawn and secretive. He misbehaves. He talks back and says things that sound like nonsense. His parents think he's become host to a demon.
What do you think? Martin asked. Bishop Galbraith gave Martin a hard, questioning look, then looked to Philip. Philip shook his head slightly.
Did you not hear me say that the lad's 15?
The priest said.
He'll learn, father,
Philip said. The old man turned his back to them and started limping his way to the farmhouse's front door. Philip glowered briefly at Martin, who shrugged in response. Philip gave Martin a last-minute coaching as they approached the door.
Say nothing.
Nothing. Even if they ask you a direct question, you will listen and let me do my job.
And what is your job?
Mostly to stand back and let Bishop Galbraith do his.
The farmhouse was larger than average, but inside felt close and cramped. Mrs. Mellick was what Martin's mother would describe as
plump and pleasant.
She welcomed them warmly and fussed over the bishop and Philip like having company was the best thing that had ever happened to her. Mr. Mellick grudgingly got up when they entered. The rest of the room was taken up by three young women who were clearly the daughters of Mr. and Mrs. Mellick. None of the girls were what Martin would call overweight, but the Mellicks were a stoutly framed family, and farm work had made them more so. Mr. Mellick introduced the girls as Kitty, Evie, and Maggie. Martin saw Philip's demeanor change as they entered the hut. He stood taller and looked more serious. He seemed to see everything. Bishop Galbraith's demeanor hadn't changed at all. Martin wasn't sure it could. The priest said,
I'm sure you're aware of Philip. He's a powerful wizard.
Oh, I'm aware of him, Father,
Mr. Mellick said.
Though I'm not sure why you brought him along.
Philip's nostrils flared, and his voice resonated.
I hold the forces of darkness at bay. I command spirits and demons. I have the power to send them back to the unknown dimensions in which they dwell.
Bishop Galbraith said,
You can see how that would be handy.
Mrs. Mellick said,
I'm not sure that this is really needed. He's a good boy. It's just,
Mr. Mellick turned to her as if a mosquito had bitten him on the ear.
You hush. I've told you it's needed. Their boy's got a demon in him. It's the only thing that makes sense. The girls all agree, don't you?
He turned to look at the girls, who were standing together in a clump. They nodded vigorously, stopping the instant he turned his attention back to Bishop Galbraith. Mr. Mellick invited the visitors to sit, then pointed at Martin.
Who's the lad?
He's my apprentice, Philip said.
Oh!
Mrs. Mellick said, lighting up as her maternal instincts kicked into gear.
That must be very exciting.
It is,
Philip responded. Mrs. Mellick looked directly at Martin.
Are you learning a lot?
He is,
Philip responded. Mrs. Mellick was taken aback.
Can he not speak?
No, he cannot,
Philip said. Her large, wet eyes filled with large, wet sympathy. She put a hand on Martin's elbow so gently he barely felt it. Martin had never wanted to hug another person so badly in his life.
Poor lad! Why can't he speak? What happened to him?
I ordered him not to,
Philip answered. Mr. Mellick nodded.
Quite right. Young people should be seen but not heard. Isn't that right, girls?
His daughters nearly gave themselves whiplash while nodding agreement. There were two benches, each of which seemed designed for four average people or three full-grown Mellicks. Mr. Mellick sat about two-thirds of the way across one bench. There wasn't enough room for anyone to sit on his left. Mrs. Mellick sat perched on the far right end of the bench next to her husband. The guests were invited to sit on the other bench. Martin started toward the bench, but Philip stopped him.
Stand back and watch,
he whispered before he settled on the bench next to Bishop Galbraith. Bishop Galbraith saw that the three daughters were still standing and quickly stood himself.
Please, ladies, do sit as well.
He looked around the room, but there was nothing else to sit on.
They can't. You're sitting on their bench, but you're our guests and are welcome to it. Isn't that right, girls?
More nodding, but Mr. Mellick didn't see it because he didn't look. Philip looked at the girls, then the bench, then the girls again, and asked the question Martin wanted to ask.
Does young Donald sit on the floor?
Not in my house, he doesn't. I'm raising him to be a man, not an animal.
Then, does he sit on the bench with his sisters?
Philip pressed.
Why does it matter where the boy sits?
The elder Donald asked.
I need to check for demonic residue.
Oh, is that what that is?
The youngest sister blurted before every Mellick in the room's eyes silenced her.
When they were younger, the boy sat on the bench with his sisters, but they're all too grown.
Philip tried to give the subject a rest, but after a moment, even Bishop Galbraith needed to know.
So, where does the lad sit?
The bishop asked.
He's young and has strong legs,
Mr. Mellick said.
Standing will help make a man out of him.
Philip turned and made eye contact with Martin. He didn't need to say anything. In one sentence, Donald Mellick had said it all. Bishop Galbraith asked probing questions, and in answering them, a clear picture of young Donald's life emerged. His father was a simple man, not dumb, but simple. He loved hunting, fishing, and farming. He married Jan and set out to create a son with whom he could hunt, fish, and farm. Three attempts left him with three daughters to feed via hunting, fishing, and farming, and still nobody, as far as he was concerned, to hunt, fish, or farm with. When Donald, the younger, was born, his father tried to ensure that his son shared his passion for outdoorsmanship by talking about nothing else for 15 solid years. The boy had not wanted for attention and love, though. It appeared his mother and sisters had loved him to within an inch of his life. Their father gave the girls permission to speak, and speak they did, at length, about how they all took an active role in raising their baby brother, helping to feed him, to dress him, reminding him to stand up straight, say please and thank you, to not talk back, to respect his elders, to do as he's told, and above all else, to be grateful that he has so many people who care about him.
But no matter how much we correct him, he isn't grateful,
Kitty, the eldest Mellick girl, said. Lately, Donald had become quiet and sullen. He'd moved to an old shed out back.
I don't see why,
Mr. Mellick said.
I've worked damn hard to give him a nice place to stand in here. The worst of it is that he's taken to hanging around with those bastards.
Which bastards?
The priest asked. Philip said,
I think he means the bastards. They're sort of a gang. Only the leader, Klooge, and a few of his buddies are really scary. Most of them are just kids who hang out playing and listening to bad music.
Martin had not mentioned his encounter with Klooge and his gang to Philip, mostly out of embarrassment. Clearly, if Philip's opinion was correct, Martin had met the worst of Klooge's clique. Just my luck, he thought. Finally, Mrs. Mellick asked Bishop Galbraith and Philip,
What do you think? Is our little Donald possessed by a demon?
Martin shook his head. Bishop Galbraith said,
Yes, I'm certain of it. Your boy is host to a demon.
Martin had expected as much. When Philip opened his mouth, Martin anticipated an argument. Philip said,
I agree.
The shed was about 30 yards behind the main house. It looked small and leaky. Mr. Mellick led the priest and the two wizards across the yard, past an impeccably manicured vegetable garden, to the shed. When they arrived, Mr. Mellick abruptly opened the door. A voice from inside the shed yelled,
I told you to knock!
Mr. Mellick yelled back,
And I told you it's my bloody shed and my bloody door and I don't need nobody's permission to open it. Stand up straight, boy. You got visitors.
Donald came to the door. He had lank, greasy hair and an impressive collection of blemishes. His general bearing said that he didn't want to see anybody. Mr. Mellick invited Martin, Philip, and Bishop Galbraith into the shed over his son's protests. He started to come in as well, but Bishop Galbraith stopped him.
What transpires within these walls is not for your eyes.
Why not? They're my walls, and the boy is my son.
Bishop Galbraith was firm.
We cannot proceed if you remain here. Terrible forces will be unleashed. If you stayed, you would see things you could never forget, things that would shake you to your very core.
Donald the Elder turned to go back into the house, but stopped after one step. He turned back to face Bishop Galbraith. His eyes softened and his eyebrows arched, making him look both concerned and puzzled.
You lot aren't going to hurt my boy, are you? Look, I know what I said, and I meant every word. I don't want to be so hard, but it's a hard world, and I don't want to see him hurt.
The bishop put a reassuring hand on the man's shoulder.
I give you my word. We will not hurt the boy. Now, please, leave us to it. Go back to your home and keep the ladies in there as well. We'll let you know when it's over.
Philip made a show of producing a jar of mystery dust from his hat and then sprinkling the dust on the ground in front of the shed. Then he waved the figure made of sticks in his left hand and the dead frog in his right. Mr. Mellick watched for a moment, shook his head, and went into the house, shutting the door behind him. The bishop turned to Philip and said,
Please see to it that we're not disturbed.
Philip dropped the frog and the stick figure on the ground. He walked to the nearest exterior corner of the shed, put his back to the corner, took 3 large paces, planted his staff firmly on the ground, and said,
Nevidebla barilo timiga.
He then walked the perimeter of the shed, maintaining his distance, and every few yards planting his staff again. When he had walked a full lap of the shed, he planted the staff again and repeated,
Nevidebla barilo timiga.
Martin understood that Philip had created a boundary of some sort. He asked if it would hurt anyone who tried to cross it.
Heavens no, Philip said. The shed will glow and they'll hear a random combination of screaming, growling, and chanting. The closer they get to the shed, the louder and brighter it will get.
He told the bishop it was done, and they all went back into the shed, closing the door behind them. From the outside, the shed looked tiny, but it felt noticeably larger on the inside. It helped that it was practically empty. There was a pile of straw in the corner that served as a bed. There were some stout, round chunks of firewood that served as seats, Martin guessed. The boy's meager possessions, a knife and a candle, were on a broad, flat hunk of firewood that was acting as a bedside table. Along one wall, 2 chunks of firewood supported a rough wooden plank, on which there were a couple of interesting-looking carved pieces of wood. Martin figured that firewood served the same purpose as stolen milk crates or mail bins in his friend's bachelor apartments back in his own time. Martin felt at home in the shed. It was like a modern teenage boy's room, only much more flammable. The boy, Donald, had retreated to his pile of straw, folding up his arms and legs in an attempt to disappear. He looked out at his unwelcome guests through a screen of his own greasy hair.
Hello, Donald. It's good to see you again. I'm sorry about the circumstances.
Bishop Galbraith snorted. The boy grunted. The priest continued.
I don't know if you've met Philip or his apprentice. They're wizards.
The boy's eyes flicked quickly to Philip and Martin. He grunted again.
Mind if we sit?
The priest asked.
You're gonna anyway,
the boy said in a surprisingly deep voice.
No, this is your home, and we won't sit until you invite us to.
They all stood in silence for a few moments. Then the boy said,
Sit if you want, I don't care.
The three men each found a piece of wood and had a seat. They sat in a vague triangle. The bishop closest to the boy, Philip behind the bishop on his right, and Martin slightly further back to the left. Once they were all sitting, there was another silence, which was broken by the boy.
They think I have a demon. Do you think I have a demon?
The priest turned and looked at Philip, then looked at Martin. Philip nodded. Martin looked confused.
No,
the priest said.
I don't think you're possessed. I think you have a father who forces the land to give him what he wants and thinks he can force his family to do the same. I think you have three sisters who all think they're your mother. I think your mother loves you dearly and sees that you're a good lad, but there's only so much she can do because she's in the same family you are. I think you'd be happy to do your chores if they just leave you alone to do them. You'd likely spend more time with your family if they let you decide when. You'd probably tell them what you're thinking if they didn't constantly pester you to, then punish you for it when you do.
The boy said nothing. He just glared at the priest, not moving a muscle.
Do I have it right?
The priest asked. The boy blinked, then lunged forward. He seized the priest in a bear hug and started sobbing violently, gibbering unintelligibly. Eventually, he lost momentum and let go of the priest. Instead of going back to his pile of straw, he cleared off his end table and used it as a stool. He slumped sullenly and talked for a long time. He talked about his parents, his sisters, the other people in the village who were his age, the bastards, Kluge's frightening personal habits, girls. He talked a lot about girls. Finally, he ran out of steam. Bishop Galbraith said,
Here's the deal. That lot back in the house thinks you have a demon. We're going to convince them we rid you of it. We're going to tell them that they have to make the shed more comfortable and knock before they come in. We're going to tell them to tread lightly with you for a while, leave you alone if that's what you want. But we need you to promise to make an effort to be nice to your family. It's hard, but it will make your life easier. Any time you need to talk, you can come to me or Philip. Tell your family that you're thinking of becoming a wizard or a priest, and they're like that.
Can I become a wizard?
The boy asked.
No,
Philip said.
Sorry, you're either born with it or you're not. Your parents don't know that, though.
Can I become a priest?
No,
Bishop Galbraith said, to Martin's surprise.
Not yet, at least. Let's talk again when things have settled down with your folks a bit. We don't want you joining the church just because it seems like a nicer place to live.
Philip rubbed his hands together.
Now that that's all settled, it's time for the fun part.
Bishop Galbraith chuckled.
Yes, I suppose it is. Shall I go, or do you think your apprentice is ready to help?
Oh, I fully trust him to do his part, Philip said. He'll probably be better at it than you or I.
Donald was not comfortable with the direction the conversation was going.
What are you talking about?
I'm kind of wondering about that myself, Martin said.
We'll explain, Philip said.
Bishop Galbraith turned back to Donald. He put a reassuring hand on the boy's knee.
Donald, the next 5 minutes will be very unpleasant. I think you'll enjoy it.
Donald's family was sitting on their benches, looking concerned, when Martin burst in the back door. He looked like he was barely staving off panic. Everyone else turned to face him, but Mrs. Mellick rose instantly to her feet. Martin looked frantically around the room.
What do you need, lad?
Mrs. Mellick asked. Martin darted around the room, clearly hunting for something he couldn't find.
We need a plank, a platter, something broad and flat. The bishop needs it for his sacraments.
Kitty!
Mrs. Mellick snapped.
Fetch the good platter!
The girl seemed too stunned to move.
Go!
Jan Mellick said, and Kitty leapt up from the bench and ran to the kitchen, which was really just a well-organized corner of the main room.
What else do you need?
Martin squeezed his eyes shut and wiggled his fingers in an attempt to dislodge the information stuck in his brain.
Juice, or cider, or something like that. My master says the boy will need something to drink, something nourishing that will give him back his strength.
We have a jug of cider, but it's gone a bit hard.
That'll do, Martin said.
Cider's not cheap, you know,
Mr. Mellick said.
It'll do,
Mrs. Mellick said.
Been saving it, letting it harden up, Mr. Mellick.